This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, Internet. Welcome to another episode of Quiz and Hers, the trivia podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory. My name is Justin.
I never say in a 10-week battle for glory.
You didn't even say the catchphrase last episode.
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Okay, if you say so.
I 100% did.
So anyway, my name is Justin. That other voice you already heard yelling at me is my wife, Hallie.
Hi.
Hallie, you are currently up 2-0 on the season.
Yep.
But I have my first opportunity to get some points today. So if you're new to the podcast, thanks for stopping by. Here's how it works. Each week, one of us, this week Hallie, writes 6 questions to ask the other person from our 6 categories, which are arts and literature, times and places, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. And everything else includes literally everything else, quizworthy from science and math to mythology and religion to law, economics, business, etc. Anything you can think of that doesn't fit in the others.
Yep.
Each game is also related to some common theme, and after each of the six questions, Hallie will talk about the answer for about 5 minutes to teach us all something we didn't know before.
I didn't say that last time.
No, you didn't. I know. Well, I'm ready when you are.
Okay.
All right.
So, this game is my first sequel.
Ah, wonderful. I've done...
At least two.
I did a sequel to my Dragons episode. And
unsolved
a sequel to my
threes.
Unsolved Quizteries episode, yes.
I guess that was it.
All right.
All right.
So, what is it a sequel to?
I call this game Too Frozen, Too Frigid. It is unrelated to the movie Frozen, but it's a sequel to my game about
ice baby
that are cold. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, so more cold shit.
More cold shit.
Like your apartment.
Yes, right now.
Yes. This place is absolutely fucking freezing, and
it is cold here.
I miss my apartment
in Florida.
In
the northern hemisphere.
Yes. All right, nice.
Okay, ready for question one?
Yes.
It is arts and literature.
Okay.
What painter and printmaker born around 1525 in what is now the Netherlands was one of the first of his generation not to do portraits and instead painted many landscapes, including winter landscapes such as the hunters in the snow, and winter landscape with skaters and a bird trap.
Hmm. Okay. 16th century Dutch, known for landscapes. I don't even know where to start with this one. I don't know. All the Dutch masters I can think of did portraits, which I guess was sort of the point of the question.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You want to say something?
I can't think of anything.
You don't want to say anything?
I don't have anything to say.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you?
Yeah.
It's Peter Bruegel the Elder.
Okay, rings a bell. Don't know anything about him.
Bruegel
comes up relatively often. But,
it does.
But I know nothing about him.
Okay,
so,
I'll tell you
okay.
What we know.
Enlighten me.
Unfortunately, not much is known about Peter Bruegel the Elder's early life. It is known that he was born sometime between 1525 and 1530 in what is now the Netherlands. Nothing is even known about his family background, with some assuming that he had a peasant background, and others believing he was highly educated due to the intellectual content of his works. However, his education may not have been that advanced, as he had to have others add the Latin captions in some of his drawings.
What a rube.
I know, right? Come on. Between 1545 and 1550, he was a pupil of Peter Koch van Elst. Let's hope I'm saying that right. Whose wife, Maiken Verhulst, connected Bruegel with work. Meaning, like, she helped get him jobs.
Right, she found him commissions.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Bruegel later married their daughter, Maiken Koch, in 1563. In 1551, Bruegel entered the Antwerp Painters Guild and became a freemaster in the Guild of St. Luke of Antwerp. He traveled to Italy in 1553, then came back to Antwerp in 1555, where his designs, known as the Large Landscapes, were published by Hieronymus Cock.
Hieronymus.
Hieronymus Cock.
Like Hieronymus Bosch.
Like Humongous Cock. Just kidding. It's Hieronymus Cock. It's a great name.
It'd be a good porn star name.
I know, right? Hieronymus Cock. Anyway, he was a famous print publisher in Northern Europe. Anyway, Bruegel lived in Antwerp until 1563, where he designed over 40 prints for Cock. In 1563, he got married in Brussels and stayed there for the rest of his life. Bruegel's most famous works come from these later years, which he mostly spent painting. He specialized in genre paintings, which portray aspects of everyday life, usually including a landscape element as well. At the time, it was very rare amongst painters to focus on peasant life, and he was one of the pioneers of genre painting.
That's cool.
Yep. His earlier paintings showed them as dozens of small figures seen from a high viewpoint and spread across the central space of the painting.
Them being peasants.
Yeah, the people.
Okay.
They showed things such as hunting, agriculture, meals, festivals, games, and dances, part of the folk culture in Belgium at the time. His famous painting, Netherlandish Proverbs, depicts aphorisms of the time, some of which are still used today, even in English, like banging one's head against a brick wall and the world being turned upside down. So basically he had like little peasants depicting all these different...
Each of these sayings.
Right.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
What's it called?
It's called Netherlandish Proverbs.
Okay.
I like the word Netherlandish.
Yeah. I feel like that's something that would come up in trivia is that work. That's really cool. I like that. Okay.
Yeah. So he also painted community events, like in his paintings, The Peasant Wedding and The Fight Between Carnival and Lent. In The Peasant Wedding, he painted every person as an identifiable individual, whereas in The Fight Between Carnival and Lent, the people are unidentifiable, meant to be allegories of greed or gluttony. The Fight Between Carnival and Lent is meant to be a satire of the conflicts of the Protestant Reformation, which were going on at the time.
Huh, okay.
In addition to genre paintings, Bruegel also painted religious scenes in a Flemish landscape setting, like Conversion of Paul and the Sermon of St. John the Baptist. His most famous landscapes include Hunters in the Snow and Landscape with the Fall of Icarus. Overall, Bruegel painted about 40 surviving paintings. He only etched one plate himself, called The Rabbit Hunt, but he designed about 40 prints, including engravings and etchings.
Hmm.
After he got married in 1563, Bruegel and his wife had two sons and a daughter. Their sons, Peter Bruegel the Younger and Jan Bruegel the Elder, both became well-known painters like their father.
Yeah, I was going to say I've heard of Peter Bruegel the Younger, too.
Right.
I haven't heard of Jan, though.
Yeah, he's a thing.
Okay.
But Bruegel the Elder died in 1569, so he wasn't able to train them himself.
Ah.
And that's it.
Nice.
Yep. Ready for question two?
I am ready.
It is times and places.
Okay.
What region of Russia, which is the largest subnational governing body by area in the world and is inhabited by people of Turkic descent, had the coldest temperature ever recorded in the world at -67.8 degrees Celsius, aka -90 degrees Fahrenheit? There are two names. I'll take one of them.
Siberia?
Is that your final answer?
I guess?
No.
What is it?
It's the Sakha Republic, or Yakutia.
Okay. What?
You've heard of it.
Oh, because you have a friend who is of Yakut descent.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard of the people. I've never heard the name of the place.
Oh, it's called the I'm going to tell you about it now.
Okay.
Did you know that it's the largest subnational... Well, I just told you that, but isn't that interesting?
Like, it's bigger than California, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Or, like, Alaska, I guess.
Yeah, right, yes.
Yeah, it's huge.
Wow, okay.
So, Yakutia comprises half of the Far Eastern Federal District, the largest of 8 federal districts in Russia. And like I said, it's the largest subnational governing body at over 3 million square kilometers, which is almost 1.2 million square miles.
Wow.
Yeah. It is just slightly smaller than India.
Jeez.
Yeah. However, the population, of course, is much smaller than India at about 960,000 people.
As opposed to a billion.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
The capital is the city of Yakutsk. Also, like I mentioned, it has had the coldest temperatures ever recorded in the towns of Verkhoyansk and Oymyakon. I'm really struggling. Verkhoyansk is actually known as the Northern Hemisphere's Pole of Cold. Like, it's just the coldest place.
You'd think that would be the North Pole.
You would, but it's not.
That's interesting.
It's Verkhoyansk.
Okay.
I don't know if that will come up in trivia, but now you know. The waters north of Yakutia are the coldest and iciest in all of the northern hemisphere, being covered by ice for 9 to 10 months of the year.
Jeez.
Yeah. The north 40% is in the Arctic Circle and is covered by permafrost. I'm talking about the region.
Right.
The middle latitudes are still tundra, but lichen and moss can grow, and reindeer also live there. In the southern part, there is a taiga forest region filled with fir and pine trees. There are several rivers in the region, the largest of which is the Lena River, as well as over 800,000 lakes.
800,000?
Yes.
Wow.
I know.
That's wild. Also, I like the word taiga a lot.
Yeah, me too.
Like a sub-tundra region?
Yeah.
It's a fun word that you don't hear enough.
Isn't there like a rapper called Tyga? T-Y-G-A?
I think there is. I doubt his name has much to do with the sub-tundra region.
But maybe he really liked that word, so that's why he picked it.
My guess is it's probably just a deliberate mispronunciation of tiger.
I think you're right.
Continue.
The bodies of many prehistoric animals from the Pleistocene epoch have been found in Yakutia, preserved in ice or permafrost. That's just a fun fact.
That is fun.
Yeah. The Turkic Saka people, aka Yakuts, settled there in the 13th and 14th centuries. The Turkic peoples are a collection of ethno-linguistic groups of Central, Eastern, Northern, and Western Asia, and parts of Europe and North Africa, so like a pretty large area.
Indeed.
Modern Turkic-speaking ethnic groups also include the Turkish people, Azerbaijanis, Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Turkmens, and Kyrgyz people, basically all the stans.
Right.
Right. And by the 17th century, most of the indigenous people of Yakutia assimilated into the Saka.
Okay, yeah.
In 1638, the Moscow government formed a new administrative center in Fort Lensky, the future city of Yakutsk. Russians settled there throughout the 17th century and began to form a community there in the 18th century. The Irkutsk Governorate, which included the area, was established in 1782, and in 1805, the Yakutsk Oblast split from it.
I've heard that. I've heard of the Yakutsk Oblast.
Yeah, that's it. That's the area.
Okay.
At this point, the Yakutsk Oblast included the Russian territories in the Pacific, but in 1856, they split from Yakutia and became part of the Primorskaya Oblast. Because of its remoteness, it became where the Tsarist and Communist governments of Russia would send people into exile.
That's interesting.
Yeah. As of 2010, the population of Yakutia was 50% Yakuts, 38% Russians, and smaller numbers of Evenks, Ukrainians, Evens, and Tatars. Those are other groups.
Well, yeah.
I've heard of Ukrainians.
You've heard of Tatars?
I have.
I would assume if you know anything about Genghis Khan.
Oh, true.
Because they were his, like, mortal enemies.
Right.
Check out our good friends over at Body Count Podcast if you want to learn way too much about Genghis Khan. They have a great 4-part series on him.
It's a lot. It's good.
I love that series.
Me too.
Anyway.
Before the area was invaded by the Russian Empire, most of the population followed the religion Tengrism, a Central Asian religion characterized by shamanism, animism, and ancestor worship.
Yeah.
When the Russians arrived, the local population was converted to the Russian Orthodox Church. Although there is still an Orthodox Christian following there today, there is interest in renewing the traditional religions. And that's where they are at today.
So it's called Yakutia, is the region?
Yeah, the Sakha Republic or Yakutia.
And the people are called Yakuts. And right. The city is called Yakuts.
Or Sakha people.
Right. And what's the city? Yakuts?
Yakutsk.
Yakutsk, with a K.
Yes, it ends with a K.
Okay. As so many Russian cities do.
Right.
Cool.
All right, you haven't gotten any yet.
No,
we'll
I haven't.
We'll see if you get this one. This right. game might be backloaded.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, you only got two last week, so.
I know. I guess we've both upped our game.
Well, we had a really, like, bizarrely high-scoring season last time, so maybe we should up our game a little bit.
Yeah, maybe.
All right.
All right, question three is music.
Okay.
What British-American rock band formed in 1976 had a hit with the song Cold as Ice off their first eponymous album, along with the hits Feels Like the First Time and Long, Long Way From Home?
I don't remember.
You don't know this?
I should.
Oh, boy.
I can't think of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Guess. A British-American rock band from the 70s.
There's like 10,000 of those.
Yeah, but name a big one. I don't know.
I don't know. Led Zeppelin.
No.
I know.
It's Foreigner.
Oh, I would never have thought of them.
Really?
No.
Oh, I like them.
I don't know them that well, so.
This game is rough. Oh, well. In 1976, English musician Mick Jones' band, Leslie West Band, had just collapsed and he was left alone in New York City. His manager encouraged him to continue writing songs, and soon he teamed up with New York keyboardist Al Greenwood. At some sessions, he met Englishman Ian MacDonald, as well as Dennis Elliott, also a Brit. Jones was having a hard time finding a singer and ended up calling Lou Gramm, who was previously the lead singer of The Black Sheep, who was the right fit. Finally, they added bassist Ed Gagliardi to complete the sextet. They originally called themselves Trigger, but when they found out the name was already taken, Jones came up with the name Foreigner based on the fact that three of them were English and three were American, so half of them would always be foreigners.
See, I think if that had been in the question, I probably would have gotten there, because that's like one of the only facts I know about them.
What?
That's why they're named Foreigner.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah, I like that fact. I heard that on a game show once, I think. Anyway.
Bud Prager, Jones' original manager, signed on as the band's manager. Their debut album, Foreigner, was released in March 1977 and sold over 400 million copies in the United States. It stayed in the top 20 for a whole year and had the hits Cold as Ice, Feels Like the First Time, and Long, Long Way from Home, which I mentioned in the question.
Yep.
Within months of releasing this album, they were already selling out U.S. arenas. The next year, they went on a tour of Europe, Japan, and Australia. Their second album, called Double Vision, was released in June 1978 and included the hits Double Vision, Hot Blooded, and Blue Morning, Blue Day.
I like Hot Blooded.
Yeah, it's a good song. This album sold 5 million records. And for their third album, Head Games, bassist Ed Gagliardi was replaced with Englishman Rick Wills. The main hits from Head Games were Dirty White Boy and Head Games. I've never heard of those.
No, me neither.
The cover of Head Games showed a little girl in the boys' bathroom erasing her number off the wall, and apparently a lot of radio stations thought it was inappropriate and therefore didn't play it, so it wasn't as much of a hit as their first two albums.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
In 1980, Jones fired co-founders Al Greenwood and Ian MacDonald so he and Gramm could write most of the music. They began working on the next album called Four, which was released in July 1981 and had hits like Waiting for a Girl Like You, Jukebox Hero, and Break It Up. Their next album, Agent Provocateur, was released in December 1984 and had their first and only number one hit, I Want to Know What Love Is.
I'd like to think I would have gotten it if that was in the question, but...
You would not have.
What?
In the late 80s, Jones and Gramm each were working on solo albums. In 1990, Gramm decided to leave the group and form his own band, which never really did anything. The band got some new members for some smaller performances, and in 1992, Gramm rejoined Foreigner. They continued to tour for the next decade, but Gramm left again in 2003, and they hired singer Kelly Hansen. Their latest album, Can't Slow Down, was released in 2009 and had two top 20 singles, When It Comes to Love and In Pieces.
Hmm.
I know, it's very recent.
I don't know either of those songs.
Me neither.
Huh.
And finally, in 2013, Jones and Gramm were inducted to the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Nice, but Foreigner is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I checked, no.
That's surprising.
I know. Maybe I checked wrong. I don't know.
No, I'm sure you got that right, but that's got to be one of the ones who's, like, coming up soon, you would think.
Yeah, I would think.
Huh. All right, so I'm 0 for 3. That's not good. But it does bring us to halftime, which is when we pause for a moment to thank you guys for listening and for spending some time with us to learn something new. Obviously, I'm learning a lot this game because I haven't gotten any of these questions so far. We also like to remind you that we are on all podcasting platforms that we are aware of, so please be sure to like and subscribe to the show. And if you feel like it, give us a rating and a review. It really does help us out. We are also very proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. There is Quiz and Hers merchandise on bigheadsmedia.com if you want to buy a t-shirt or a hoodie with our logo, hand-drawn by my wife and co-host. You can do that. We also encourage you to check out all of our other podcasts on Big Heads Media. They are all fantastic. There are podcasts there about literally everything in the world that you can imagine. ranging from your favorite sports team. Yes, I think we have all of them, or we're getting pretty close.
Nice.
And also pop culture and games, anything you could want to learn more about or just hear people bullshit about, you can find it there. So check out bigheadsmedia.com. And we'll now send you over to a quick ad for another Big Heads Media podcast.
On Is It Philosophy, we are not going to explore the philosophers of times long forgotten. We're not going to ponder Plato or Socrates. There's so many podcasts out there for that, if that's what you're seeking. This is something different. A place where all ideas are welcome. An open forum to talk about anything and everything. We take an idea and work to find an answer. It may not be the most insightful. Hell, it may not even be an answer at all. So come and listen with an open mind. Who knows, you may like what we have to say. If not, at least we've given you something to think about. So come and enjoy and ask yourself, is it philosophy?
All right, we're back. Let's continue this debacle.
All right, let's keep in mind this goes from hard to easier.
I hope so.
Okay. Question 4. Sports and games.
Okay.
What form of hockey, also known as Russian hockey, uses a round ball instead of a puck and is played on a field the size of a soccer field?
Okay, so it's played on a field with a ball.
Yeah.
But it must be... So there's no link to your theme in that question. Other than...
It's a form of hockey.
Hockey. Wait, is that the whole link?
It's ice hockey.
But it's not ice hockey. That's the whole point, right?
I mean, the name of the sport is not ice hockey, because it's different from ice hockey, but it's played on ice.
Oh, it is played on ice.
Yeah.
So it's not a field, it's a rink. It's just an enormous rink?
Yes, it's played on, like, a soccer field that's turned into ice.
I see. Tundra hockey.
Fun, but no.
Okay, this game is ridiculous, but sorry. What is it?
Bandy.
What?
Bandy.
I've never heard of that.
I'm trying to learn things.
Okay.
Okay.
There are probably like 7 Big Four sports teams you could have done that would fit this theme.
Sure, I guess.
All right, whatever.
But I didn't want to be like, what ice hockey team? Blah, blah, blah.
We boring. Do that sometimes.
Yeah, but we could do more fun ins that aren't through ice.
No, I mean, there's probably teams with, like, names that would fit for this.
Like what?
I don't know.
Okay. Bandy originally developed in Eastern England in the late 19th century. In the fens, or marshes, large expanses of ice would form, so skating was always common in the area. The rules of bandy were first published in 1882 by the Bury Fen Bandy Club, who introduced it to other countries. The first international match happened pretty soon after that in 1891.
Penguins. Pittsburgh Penguins would have worked.
All right, fine. Whatever.
I just thought of that.
Whatever, man. I hate them. Anyway.
All right,
no
continue.
Offense. So the international match happened pretty soon after that in 1891 between Bury Fen and the Haarlem Hockey and Bandy Club from the Netherlands. That year, the National Bandy Association was started in England. In 1902, the first National Bandy League was started in Sweden. It was played at the Nordic Games in 1901, 1903, and 1905. They ended in 1926, if you were wondering.
The Nordic Games did?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a good, interesting fact.
It is.
There was also a European Bandy Championship in 1913, with 8 countries participating. Since then, it has mostly been popular in Russia. They were a founding nation of the International Federation of Bandy in 1955 and have been the most successful team at the World Championships.
Well, if that's the only country where it's popular, that's
not
surprising.
Oh, there's more. I'll tell you more.
Okay.
Ice hockey was developing in Canada around the same time as bandy, but they did not introduce it to Europe until the early 20th century. Prior to that, hockey was another name for bandy, and it is still sometimes called hockey in Russia and Kazakhstan. After hockey became bigger in Europe, it became common for players to play both football and bandy at different times of the year. That way they had, like, something to do for both
right.
times.
Yeah. Okay.
In Sweden, most
by football you mean soccer.
Yes, yeah. Sorry. In Sweden, most of the football clubs in the early 20th century also played bandy. This became less common as the seasons for each sport became longer. Ice hockey eventually became more popular than bandy throughout Europe, mostly because it was an Olympic sport and bandy was not. Most bandy players switched to hockey in the 1920s so that they could compete in the Olympics. So let me get to how the sport actually works. Like I said, it is played with a round ball instead of a puck. The sticks look like something between an ice hockey stick and a field hockey stick. Also, like I mentioned, it is meant to be played on a field the size of a soccer field. Also, similar to football, soccer, each team has 11 players.
Okay.
If the teams have the same number of goals at the end of the game, they usually just call it a draw, unlike hockey.
Right.
The players cannot touch the ball with their head, hands, or arms. They usually use their sticks to move the ball, but they can also use any part of their body to move the ball, except the ones I just said.
So they could kick it if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Interesting. Do they wear skates?
Yeah.
Okay.
Another difference from hockey is that there's a sideline, whereas hockey is contained within a rink.
Right.
If the ball goes off the bandy field, the referee decides which team touched the ball last and awards the restart stroke to the other team, just like in football. Soccer.
Right, yeah.
There are three main categories of players, which are forwards, who mainly score the goals, defenders, who prevent their opponents from scoring, and midfielders, who take the ball from opposition and pass it to the forwards.
So it's lacrosse.
Kind of.
Okay. I talked about that.
Yep.
I forget when.
A while ago.
Yeah, not sure.
Today, there are 27 members of the Federation of International Bandy. In 2001, the International Olympic Committee approved it as a recognized sport. The Bandy World Championship was held every 2 years beginning in 1961 and every year since 2003. The skill of the 20 national teams varies a lot. Finland won once in 2004, and all the other championships have been won by either Sweden, the Soviet Union, or Russia. So, like...
Russia.
Sweden or Russia.
Jeez.
Yeah. The first world championship for women was in 2004, and not surprisingly, Sweden won. They won every year until 2014 when Russia finally beat them. So it's basically Russia and Sweden.
Okay.
The FIB, whatever it is, Federation International of Bandy, mm-hmm. President Boris Skrinik lobbied for bandy to be played at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, and they even met in 2017 to discuss having it in the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing, but the International Olympic Committee says there is, quote, a gap between popularity and participation and global audiences. Fair enough, since I've never heard of it before.
No, me neither.
But it's like huge in these two countries.
Interesting.
Yep.
Huh. Okay.
Okay. Two more questions.
And I still haven't gotten a single one.
I'm sorry. Question five. Everything else. What British-Dutch consumer goods company, whose name sounds like a simple machine, but is actually a combination of two companies that merged in 1929, owns several brands that make frozen desserts, including Good Humor and Ben & Jerry's?
Is it Unilever?
Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
It is.
Yes. Thank God.
Yay.
Okay.
So like I said, Unilever is a British-Dutch company. It has headquarters in London and Rotterdam. 40% of its products are foods and beverages. They also produce cleaning agents, beauty products, and other toiletries.
That's mostly what I think of them for, actually. I don't know why. Like soaps and shit.
Interesting. Like, are you thinking of the Lever soap?
Probably.
I don't think that's related, as far as I know.
No, I don't know. They make like a whole bunch of soaps and shit, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Okay.
It is one of the oldest multinational companies, and its products are sold in about 190 countries. That means there are fewer than 10 countries that don't have their products, so that's insane.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like I mentioned in the question, Unilever was formed in 1929 when the company Dutch Margarine Uni and British soap maker Lever Brothers combined. So maybe it is the Lever soap people.
I think so.
It must be, right?
Yeah.
In the 1930s, they expanded their business to Africa and Latin America. During World War II, they couldn't expand in Europe, so they decided to expand into the United States. They started by purchasing TJ Lipton, which had a majority stake in Frosted Foods, which owned Bird's Eye, as well as Bachelor's Peas, one of the largest vegetable canners in the UK. Then, in 1944, they acquired Pepsodent, an American toothpaste brand. In 1945, the Lipton and Lever brands began to decline, so Unilever left the American management to handle it themselves.
I checked. Yes, Lever Brothers is part of, like, Lever soap. Yeah.
Okay. That's why, probably. In 1957, Unilever took full ownership of Frosted Foods and changed its name to Bird's Eye. Fun fact, the founder of Bird's Eye was actually named Frank Bird's Eye II.
What?
His last name was Bird's Eye. No joke.
That's... Okay. That sounds like a joke.
It's not.
Right. Ah, yes, the Birdseye Company, founded by Frank Birdseye II.
It's true.
It sounds like an improv joke.
No, it's true.
That's amazing.
I know. Anyway, in 1961, they acquired Good Humor, which was also based in the U.S. At the time, laundry soap and edible fats still made up about half of Unilever's profits. But there was a lot of competition from Procter & Gamble, so in 1978, Unilever acquired National Starch for $487 million, which was the largest foreign acquisition of a U.S. company ever at the time.
Huh.
By this time, Unilever had also gained 30% of the Western European ice cream market. In 1984, in the company's first successful hostile takeover, listen back to Justin's Quizish Invasion episode, right?
Yes, that's the one.
Unilever acquired Brooke Bond, a brand of tea in the UK. Then, in 1986, they further strengthened their position by acquiring Cheese Bro Ponds, which made ragu sauces, Ponds beauty products, Aquanet hairspray, Q-Tex nail care products, and Vaseline products, which is a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about diversification.
Yeah, they do everything. In 1989, they also bought Calvin Klein Cosmetics and Fabergé Cosmetics.
What?
Cosmetics.
Okay, so like the cosmetics arms of Calvin Klein and Fabergé?
Yes.
Those are some big gets.
Yeah.
Jeez.
In the 90s, they focused back on food again and acquired Breyers from Kraft, officially making Unilever the largest ice cream manufacturer in the United States. In 1996, they purchased Helene Curtis, a shampoo and deodorant company which owns Suave and Finesse hair care products and Degree deodorant.
So they just own everything.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Then, in April of 2000, they purchased Ben & Jerry's and SlimFast for £1.63 billion. I'm not sure why that's in pounds. Ben & Jerry's and SlimFast are American, I think.
But this is a British company.
Right.
So that's probably
why. We're in dollars. I don't know why we switched.
Okay.
Anyway. The same year, they acquired Best Foods for £13.4 billion. Best Foods owned brands like Knorr's, Marmite, Bovril, and Hellman's.
So lots of super British food brands.
And Hellman's.
And Hellman's, yes, right.
This acquisition was the second largest cash acquisition in business history.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know what the first was, sorry. What?
Nothing. You should check these things. They're interesting.
Yeah, I should. I mean, this is interesting enough.
Yes, it is.
In 2001, they split into two separate divisions, one for foods and one for home and personal care. In May 2007, they became the first large company to source all its tea sustainably.
Huh.
And in February 2011, they announced that they would switch to 100% cage-free eggs. In April 2011, Unilever was fined €104 million by the European Commission for starting a price-fixing cartel with Procter & Gamble. Yeah. The fine was originally higher, but Procter & Gamble admitted to running the cartel, so Unilever got a 10% discount. Yay, I guess.
Okay.
In 2016, they purchased the U.S. startup Dollar Shave Club for $1 billion.
I've heard of them.
It was $1 times a billion. In February 2017, Kraft Heinz made a $143 billion bid for Unilever, which Unilever declined and I assume laughed in their faces.
Yeah.
In March 2018, they announced that they would be centralizing to just one headquarters in Rotterdam, but then they changed their minds because UK shareholders would lose value if they fell out of the London Stock Exchange.
Right, makes sense, yeah.
And lastly, if you're wondering, the Unilever logo is a sans serif U made up of 25 distinct symbols, each representing one of their sub-brands. So that's how diverse they are. They have 25 different sub-brands of things.
I never noticed that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's cool.
Nice. Interesting.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, you have one.
Yay.
Let's see if we can make it two.
All right.
Question six, movies and TV.
Okay.
Rankin-Bass Productions, which produced the original Frosty the Snowman TV special, mainly focused on films using what type of animation, as used in their other specials like Santa Claus is Coming to Town and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
I believe that would be stop-motion animation.
That is correct.
Yes!
Okay.
All right.
So I'm mainly going to talk about Rankin-Bass Productions as well as these Christmas movies that I know you hate.
I hate them so much.
I like some of them.
They are terrible.
Rankin-Bass Productions was founded by Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass in 1960 as Videocraft International. They called their stop-motion productions Animagic Productions. This division was headed by Japanese animator Tadahito Mochinaga at his studio called MOM Production. One of their first projects was 1960's The New Adventures of Pinocchio. Rankin Bass also had their own group of voice actors based in Toronto, including Paul Soles, Larry D. Mann, and Paul Kligman. Paul Soles is known for voicing Hermie in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and the title character in 1967's Spider-Man TV series.
Okay.
Larry D. Mann voiced Yukon Cornelius in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and Paul Kligman was Donner and Coach Comet. Kligman was also known for being the voices for J. Jonah Jameson, General Ross, Red Skull, and Krang in the Marvel superheroes and Spider-Man TV shows in the 60s.
Those shows are really bad.
Okay, I've never seen them.
I've seen bits and pieces. They're widely available on the internet. They're terrible.
Okay. In 1964, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was released on NBC as a Christmas special. It was adapted from Robert L. May's 1939 story, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which inspired the 1949 song of the same name, written by May's brother-in-law, Johnny Marks. Fun fact, both May and Marks were actually Jewish.
That's pretty good.
I know. For the stop-motion special, Marks actually composed an original orchestral score. And like I said earlier, Paul Soles voiced Hermie, Larry D. Mann voiced Yukon Cornelius, and Paul Kligman voiced Donner and Coach Comet. Burl Ives voiced Sam the Snowman, which helped the special gain popularity.
Right, I think I knew that.
I did not. Anyway.
Yeah.
The special remained with NBC until 1972 when it moved to CBS. This year, it aired on Freeform, but it will continue to air on CBS as well. Rankin Bass continued to base their Christmas specials on Christmas songs. The next one, The Little Drummer Boy, was released in 1968. This was also the year that they changed their name from Videocraft International to Rankin Bass.
Mm-hmm.
MOM Production in Tokyo was also renamed Video Tokyo Production after Tadahito Mochinaga left. In 1969, Frosty the Snowman was released with Jackie Vernon as the voice of Frosty. Then, Santa Claus is Coming to Town was released in 1970 with Mickey Rooney voicing young Kris Kringle, and Paul Frees voicing the villain, Burgmeister Meisterburger. Justin knows all of this really well, but he's not happy about it.
I grew up with this shit, and it's so terrible.
I'm sorry.
Although I don't think I've ever seen the Little Drummer Boy one, which must be really atrocious if it's not even on anymore.
Yeah, I don't think they show it anymore.
Like, they will put anything on TV during the Christmas season, so.
Yep. In 1971, they decided to do an Easter special, which was called Here Comes Peter Cottontail. Danny Kaye voiced the narrator. Vincent Price voiced the rabbit villain January Q. Irontail. And Casey Kasem voiced Peter Cottontail. So, like, really good cast.
None of that makes any sense.
It's a great cast, but it's weird.
I think I've seen this.
Really?
I think I have.
I've never even heard of it.
It's fucking horrible.
Sounds... Yeah, not great. But great cast.
A very great, very strange cast, yes.
Yeah. In 1974, they went back to Christmas specials with The Year Without a Santa Claus, which is my personal favorite. Throughout the 70s, they continued to produce animated sequels to their classic specials like 1979's Rudolph and Frosty's Christmas in July and Jack Frost. Jack Frost was narrated by Buddy Hackett and was about a snowman's love for a mortal woman. Fun fact... Buddy Hackett was also the voice of Scuttle in The Little Mermaid.
Another fun fact, snowmen die much faster than human women.
Shush!
All it takes for a snowman to die is for the sun to come out.
I know, there's a whole song about that in the prequel to The Name of My Game. It's Frozen.
Ugh.
Anyway, the last stop-motion Christmas story that Rankin Bass produced was 1985's The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus, taken from the L. Frank Baum story of the same name. Rankin Bass also attempted some live-action productions, which were all made for TV and weren't as popular as the Christmas specials. They finally shut down the production company in March 1987. In 2001, Fox aired the first original Christmas special from Rankin and Bass to be produced in 16 years. It was called Santa Baby, and characters were voiced by Patti LaBelle, Eartha Kitt, Gregory Hines, Vanessa Williams, and Tom Joyner. After that, the Rankin...
What? No, nothing.
I don't know. They were trying to be different, I guess.
Okay.
After that, the Rankin Bass partnership was dissolved, and most of the remaining assets went to Warner Brothers Television. And here we are.
Still watching this shit.
Every year.
50 years later, I know. Or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's probably more like 60. No, it's 50.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I hated that.
Yay, you got two.
I did, so we are now tied on the season 2-2. So that brings us to the end of the game, which brings us to our new segment, which we like to call Fact or Fucked. So Hallie, I have a fact or fucked for you.
Okay.
Comes to us from James, one of the minds behind the Watchtower Database YouTube channel.
Okay.
So go check them out. And here is your fact or fucked. Batman Beyond is an alternate future for the DC animated universe. Fact or fucked?
What?
It's a TV show.
Oh.
Or it was a TV show.
Oh, I hope it's a fact. I don't know. Let's go with fact.
It is fucked.
Damn!
It is not an alternate future, it is the future of the DC animated universe.
I see.
And James's YouTube channel, Watchtower Database, has an excellent video explaining how we know in canon that it is not an alternate timeline. So go check that out, guys.
That's cool.
Video is called Batman Beyond is Not an Alternate Future Confirmed.
Nice.
So check that
out. Interesting.
Yes. So that's fact or fucked, and that's the show.
And I got fucked.
You did get fucked.
By the fact. That was wrong.
So that's the show. So we are now tied 2-2 on the season. And we'll be back next week when I will have 6 new questions for Hallie, and she will have a chance to build up another lead. And we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye. The cover of Head Games showed a little girl in the boys' bathroom erasing her number off the wall, and apparently a lot of radio stations thought it was inappropriate and therefore didn't play it, so it wasn't as much of a hit.
Try again.
Sorry.